John, maybe we can start with you because it was the movement that first decided that the Leadership Roundtable would be a good partner in this whole process here. What uniqueness do they bring to the table?
Well, I think they bring a private sector or secular view of management practices and kind of best practices into the spiritual realm of the church. And and I think as we looked at our work with the Movement to Restore Trust, we realized that as a group of volunteer lay people, we could only take this so far. And right from the start, we began talking about, well, what are best practices? What are things that are working in other dioceses around the country? And very early on, I was referred to Leadership Roundtable as being a very effective party in that process. I mean, I've been a believer throughout my professional career that when you look at a situation and you've got a really thorny situation that maybe you've developed some blind spots about, or you just don't know exactly what you're dealing with. I think outside help is always a good thing. I think you can go too far in that direction. Sometimes there's the old saw that consultants are people who borrow your watch to tell you the time. I mean, so you always watch that. But I think we realized, at least from our side, we realized that we had something to learn from Leadership Roundtable. And the first time I raised this with Bishop Malone, he said, "Oh, I'm well aware of them, and I know that they've done good work around the country."
You guys know the local situation best, but there's some fresh eyes. Bishop, is that how you see their
It
partnership?
truly is. Leadership Roundtable, as John mentioned, was not a new entity to me when it was recommended by, can we call it MRT, Movement to Restore Trust, that we also partner with them, the diocese, in our partnership with MRT. I had worked with them in the past. I've served for many years on the U.S. Bishops' Committee on the Laity. I still do, although now it's Laity, Marriage, Family Life, and Youth. But I came to know Dominic Perry, who is our key person here for facilitating all of this, as we were doing some work together to advance the role of laity and lay ministry in the church. So I have great confidence in him and in them.
How are things going so far? Are they up to your expectations? What you were hoping them to bring to the table?
For me, absolutely. We have every June a major convocation of all of our priests. It's as in any profession, it's ongoing education. We call it continuing formation. And we brought Dominic in to really facilitate the whole convocation and to, first of all, to help the priests really not only hear about, but as much as you can as a non-victim, feel a little bit of what a victim feels. No one can feel that but a victim. So we brought in a victim survivor who gave a very poignant, heartfelt presentation to my priests and me. And he spared no punches, which I'm happy about. He really told them how he felt it wasn't handled well in the past. And the priests were very, very moved by that. And so it was a very powerful thing. And of course, one of the major goals of the whole meeting was that the priests would engage with the Movement to Restore Trust and in my partnership with MRT as we move this whole thing forward.
You said that you knew Dominic before. How would you characterize him? What kind of a person is he, and how forceful is he going to be? How much pressure will he put on you guys?
I would say he is very graciously forceful. He's very clear that we need to make progress that's real and also credible and observable, and not just keep talking. And I think we're doing that. We're at the beginning, but I really believe we're doing it.
Yeah, I think that's what you were calling for as well, John.
Well, yes, and it's an interesting dynamic that Dominic speaks with the bishop, and then Dominic speaks with us. And I spoke with the CEO of Leadership Roundtable when I was at a conference in Georgetown about 10 days ago, and she said, "Well, how's it going?" I said, "Well, we don't move as fast as the lay people want, but Dominic is always there to kind of educate us on how do these things really work and how to be most effective." And she says he's playing the role of Switzerland as the neutral party, and not that we have active conflict, but it's good to have a go-between where he's got the bishops here and the bishop's confidence, he has our confidence, and he's an honest broker in this process.
So I'm just trying to get kind of a sense of, you know, what the process is going to be, because that's what people want to know. You guys give regular media updates, which is terrific. Like, how is this process going to move through?
Well, I can just take a quick shot at it. We formed right away after John, representing the leadership of MRT, presented me with the results of their very significant meetings months ago. Some of that began, was it November?
In December.
A lot of commitment by a lot of people continuing on. The proposal was right away to work together with this joint team. And three or four from MRT and also from the diocese. And it really, I think, is working very well. Our meetings are very candid about the way things are and what we have to do to move forward, to renew, and I also, from a bishop's perspective, say to purify the church and help all of us to live the way we should. But it's demanding, it's challenging, but it's the right thing. I believe in it.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, from our point of view, we have the report, as you know, Marian, and there is a rather lengthy list of recommendations that we came up with. Some represent, I would say, aspirations that maybe laity have for a church that may not be completely realistic, but there were several very good recommendations. So what we tried to do with the joint implementation team is bring forward, first, was what we thought were some low-hanging fruit, things that we could do quickly and that could give people the confidence that, yes, maybe this was going to work. And then we're trying to follow that up in every meeting. What do we do to make progress on these and to check them off as being done? Right. And then we will continue to bring additional recommendations out of the reports onto the table. And we view that as our role. I mean, we're the moving party on these things, as it were. And it's up to us to say, our sense of talking with the laity is this is a priority. Let's see if we can get this done. And the bishop is right. We have very honest and candid discussions. Is it perfect? No, nothing is perfect. But you walk out of a room and you say, well, at least there was honest listening and an honest conversation. And we didn't get all the way there today, but we'll come back and we'll work at it again.
As challenging as it is, it's also, to me as a bishop at this point in my ministry, it's a very enriching experience. I have to say that. Not that it's not challenging, that it is and it needs to be. In fact, at the recent meeting of the U.S. bishops in Baltimore a couple of weeks back, a couple of my brother bishops from elsewhere in the country who know we're doing this here were asking me about it. And I said, if you don't know, if you don't have people like the movement Restore Trust, let me assure you, you do. They may not have organized, and they don't call themselves that. Mm-hmm. But why don't you watch what's going on with us? And you might want to see if something else could happen like that in your place.
So as this is going on the diocese level, what's the role of clergy and parishioners, maybe on the parish level or on individual levels?
I would say from my point of view with the MRT, we view that as the next big frontier. I came out and addressed the priests at the priest convocation about just the kind of the history of the MRT, and then a summary of the recommendations and the subject areas of the work groups. And that was, for many of the priests, the first they had really heard of it. We've been trying to communicate, but it's been imperfect. So we realize that in order for this to really become a movement, it needs to be out in the parishes. It needs to be in the pews. This at this conference I was at in Georgetown, they warned about there being a clericalism among the elite of the laity in dioceses around the country, that this has to be a movement of all faithful Catholics. And so we may have gotten something started, but we know that this is only going to be successful if it's in every parish. And so we're talking with the priests right now. We want to start that discussion with the priests. How would they see this happening most effectively in their particular parish? And then we've got to look at our resources for the MRT and say, how can we make that happen?
Yeah. Bishop, is that
Yes, and a number of my priests I've spoken with in recent days, because, as John says, their awareness of this was heightened by the convocation and John's very fine talk. A number of my priests have shown great enthusiasm about getting involved in this. In fact, I've already asked several of them to work as a little team to help us, and help me in particular, to work with MRT to move our presbyterate, our priests' community, deeper into this whole thing. You know, as you know, 50 years ago, the Second Vatican Council called for much stronger and more significant involvement of the laity, not just in things that the council did right away, like having laity as lectors at Mass or Eucharistic ministers. Those are the easy things. But the council called on the laity, first and foremost, to be leaven in the world, and also to be part of the direction of the life of the church. And it's taken a long time for that piece of it to engage really effectively and broadly. And I think we're moving, maybe in our own small way, we're moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And I've come to see that in my role at Canisius College. You know, as the first lay president after 100 and almost 150 years of Jesuit leadership, I stepped into that role and had to think about, how is it that you animate the spirit of Jesus Christ and the charism of St. Ignatius Loyola as a layperson? So I've thought all about that a lot. But I look at this work we're doing now and saying the same thing must be applied to the institutional church as a whole.
So a big portion of the process has ended, the compensation program. There are a number of folks who did not accept settlements. What happens to those cases?
86%. We were surprised, if I could say first, 86% of them though did accept it. Mm-hmm. I think probably to avoid lengthy litigation. But as you know, the Child Victims Act engages on August 14th, and so I'm sure a number of the people. I don't know this, but I'm pretty sure a number of the people who did not accept the offer from it wasn't from the diocese, from independent administrators, former judges, and other people that we don't know about yet, I'm pretty sure we'll hear from them after the 14th of August.
Yeah.
And, you know, even before the IRCP, as we call it, for decades, when a victim would approach the diocese, always there was outreach. Always they were offered counseling and all kinds of things, and a visit with the bishop and all those things.
Sure. There probably will be another, like you say, a tsunami, another wave of cases, and you really don't know how many and what that's going to mean to this process. I hope that it's not, you know, too overwhelming. How are you preparing for that?
Yeah, so from my point of view, the Child Victims Act is an important development in New York. And to the extent that it will bring about peace and healing and reconciliation for the victims of sexual abuse, I think we've got to embrace the possibilities. But we also know from what's happened here over the last 2 years that there will be a lot of media attention focused on individual allegations in lawsuits that get filed. And we want to make sure that we've made sufficient progress with the recommendations of the movement to restore trust so that we can say, yes, victims are having their day in court, and that's appropriate. But we're also working on healing the church as well. And so we've got to keep working on that, because there'd be a tendency, I think, to get overwhelmed by the negative news that might come out of this. We're going to find out here just how widespread this issue of child sex abuse is. It's not restricted to the Catholic Church. We're going to see lawsuits cropping up in many places where adults have had access to children. Regrettably so, but I think that's going to be the case.
Yeah, there has been some criticism that we still don't have a full list. The claims that have been substantiated so far, not everyone agrees with the diocese criteria on how they put out that list.
We are working, even as we speak, we're working to add more detail, more information to the names of those priests who have either admitted to abusing or for whom we have the evidence. So it's been substantiated by our independent review board.
There's also a number of priests who are on administrative leave now. We're waiting for the Vatican to take action. Is that where they'll stand?
That's an important question. There are two answers to the question. First of all, there are priests who are on administrative leave because the allegations are undergoing investigation here by professional investigators. We have a former FBI agent who does that work for us, and two other guys who used to be assistant DAs, skilled at investigation. So they're doing meticulous investigations of each of these cases, and it takes much too long for it. They just do it so carefully, but it's agonizing for everybody. So that's one piece. We're working on that all the time. The other piece is that as of 2001, just for a little quick history, Pope John Paul II issued a decree to the whole world's bishops that any time a case of substantiated abuse was discovered, and we knew it wasn't frivolous or false, that case was to be sent to the Vatican for adjudication. And for whatever reason, it never happened in this diocese. I know I was doing that in Maine. We would send the cases in. That's when you would get a judgment that a priest had been dismissed from the clerical state, laicized, or as the world calls it, defrocked, or given a sentence of a prayer of life and penance so that he could never function again as a priest. So both of those are going on right now. I began sending those cases to the Holy See, and it's in process. Seven or eight have gone over already.
Right. So in the meantime, are those priests still being supported by the diocese
yes.
financially, housing, whatever?
It's a matter of church law that a bishop is responsible for them at some level until they are dismissed from the clerical state.
Yeah. You know, the results of the preliminary investigation are one thing, and the final determination is another. So you will often have, for example, in arbitration hearings, you know, involving teachers, mm-hmm. that's often a very lengthy process sure. to get to a point of dismissal. But I don't defend the process because I will tell you that there is, and I picked up a definite sense of this at this conference in Georgetown. It was entitled Lay Leadership for a Wounded Church in a Divided Nation. And it was 60 lay leaders from around the country talking about these issues. And one thing that came out is we believe that the Vatican needs to develop a new sense about just what we're dealing with here in the United States. The process that Bishop Malone talks about is a process that's governed by canon law. It's got its own quirks to it, but it is very opaque to Americans. It doesn't comport with our notions of due process and speedy trial and things like that. And so cases languish, and that causes people to wonder what's going on. There are just way too many cases pending over there that people want to see resolved. And to be honest, for innocent priests, I think they deserve to have their day in court come quickly. So this delay is not good. And I think I don't think Rome fully understands what the impact is for the average Catholic who has seen their pastor removed from service and now is waiting, you know, seemingly forever.
Is there really nothing, though, except for Rome to do something about
that? Only the Holy Father has the authority to dismiss a man from the priesthood. But the bishops are equally frustrated by the length of time it takes when these cases go to the Vatican. Of course, they're at the Vatican from all over the world. No place has been unaffected by this tragedy, this horror of abuse of people by priests. So it's just way, way backed up more than it should be. We often kind of gripe about that, we bishops, when we're together.
Mm-hmm. The conference, let's talk about that. Leadership Roundtable and others were concerned that not enough action was taken, that you know, bishops are still policing themselves, but they did come out with some resolutions as well. And what were your thoughts?
We were raring to go back in November and to move forward on some of the same protocols that we finally put through a couple of weeks ago in Baltimore. So there was a real sense, a very strong and memorable sense of unity among the bishops that this had to be strong, it had to be effective, it had to be transparent, and it had to happen now. So that was really, really clear. And a number of proposals. The proposals that went before the bishops needed to have votes, and it would have to be a majority vote. They were the strongest votes that I can remember. I've been a bishop over 19 years now. And a couple of the documents that are about these policies and protocols, it was like 217 yes and two no, And the two no's, I figure, must be people that pressed the wrong button on the voting machine. Yeah. But there was a real consensus that this was the right way to go. And also, some of our media friends have not really been clear about this. There was a strong call also for, along the process of all these things, for lay people. It referred to lay professionals. It's what Leadership Roundtable calls experts with teeth.
Yeah.
From the laity to be involved in all of this.
But not everything has to come from the Bishops' Conference.
Right.
You have the authority to do a lot yourself.
Sure.
They did pass some standards for bishops, and those there have been allegations against, etc. And how would that something like that be incorporated into your partnership there?
Well, originally, this was one of the recommendations coming out of our working groups for the MRT, and we had put this on the table with Bishop Malone back in early April when the Joint Implementation Team first met, and we agreed together that he was going to implement essentially what has just been passed by the United States Conference. We were going to implement it voluntarily in Buffalo, and we did announce it, but in the meantime, Pope Francis ordered the bishops to study this and to come up with a recommendation, and now whatever we were going to do in Buffalo voluntarily has been superseded, not in a bad way, but because it's essentially what we wanted to see was a reporting mechanism that didn't go through the diocesan channel if you had a problem with something that your particular bishop was doing. So I think we join with Leadership Roundtable in saying that this is it's a hopeful step. I will tell you that. There are people who are they're concerned, and they want to see how does this play out, and how is it implemented. And I think Bishop Blum would probably agree the allegations just prior or during the conference meeting about Bishop Bransfield down in West Virginia give people a lot of anxiety that we still don't have this right, and what's going to prevent a situation like that from occurring? So it's the proof is going to be in the pudding as we go and see how this gets implemented. And frankly, I think it's one of these things that let's hope we don't need to use it, that our bishops are doing the right thing, and we're not complaining about bishops. But in the event that there is, I think people are going to be watching very carefully to see how does this play out.
The McCarrick. The horror of that McCarrick story, I think, really caused a lot of people to see in a different way the dimensions of this problem and the levels it can reach. So, you know, and I'll tell you what, the bishops, most of us bishops, I couldn't say most, I haven't taken account, but the bishops I've spoken to and the ones who've spoken publicly were so horrified that one of our brother bishops was involved in that kind of behavior and still kept being promoted all the way to be cardinal, and that baffles me and my brother bishops, believe me. So that this has put a whole new kind of energy into this whole effort together.
So people have expectations. Leadership Roundtable has been very encouraging. You guys are far ahead of the curve. People still have expectations of what's going to be done when, how soon, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe final thoughts that take in a half hour of your time.
Yeah, but, you know, my sense from this Georgetown conference involving these 60 lay leaders from around the country is there are many people that are still talking, I would say, at the conceptual or theoretical level as to, you know, dimensions of the problem, how do you begin to address it. And yet we were held up in Buffalo as an example of how you might make this work. And so I find myself in this work being involved in the weeds, the nitty-gritty of how do you make this happen. And what it means is we have these meetings where we've introduced Bishop Malone and the staff in his office to action registers and decision logs where we decide we're going to do something, so there's a date put by it and there's a person assigned, and when we come back the next meeting, people are called to account to hand in their homework, as it were. And
that's
that's a useful discipline. but that's what
yeah.
we're going to need to keep this on track,
yeah.
because this is a multifaceted thing. We, as you know from our working groups, we were talking about the handling of the cases of sexual abuse. But then there was financial transparency, and we wanted to talk about seminary formation, and we wanted to talk about where are we with Vatican II as an animating force here in the diocese. So there are lots of things. So we've got a big agenda, and it's a process of organizing that and just keep pushing forward.
And Leadership Roundtable has its own benchmarks and step-by-steps, and, you know, they have their own process too. I understand that there is also a cost. They are a consultant.
We're committed to it from the diocesan perspective, and also MRT is. And we've been able to take some of the, they're important but small, kind of easier steps. Mm-hmm. MRT asked, for example, that the chairperson of the Diocesan Finance Council, which has a lot of authority, be a lay person. It has always been a priest, at least as far as I know, and now there's a lay chair of that committee. And also, it was recommended we add more laity, especially women. And just last week at our meeting, three new women, very competent women, joined us at the table. There were more challenging things coming.
Sure. You're still the ultimate say-so. They are there to advise.
Not totally. No, church law requires on some, when it comes to financial matters, there are certain financial decisions the bishop cannot make without the approval of the Diocesan Finance Council. I'm not allowed to do it. So, I mean, there's not as much, authority there over everything. There is a lot for a bishop, but not as much over everything as some people like to think.
Final thoughts?
Well, I would say we'll know we're successful, Marian, when we get a sense that the principle of co-responsibility, that is the ordained Catholics and the lay Catholics working together in an equal partnership, is really working that way. So is the bishop the final arbiter? Ultimately, yes, but in a system of co-responsibility, there is a consensus building and a careful listening that is going to go on, and that's really the culture that we're trying to build here.
Because as the material that Leadership Roundtable makes available is very clear about, what we're doing right now and what we're doing in Buffalo has kind of two aims. One is to work with victims in a more compassionate, effective, responsive way, and resolve that piece of it, and continue to ensure safe environments, which we get a good record on that in recent years. But the other aim is to make a different culture of leadership throughout the church. And I feel very committed to both of those, and I'm happy to have the partnership of John and the rest of the team.
It's a big task.
It is.
I mean, even in business, you know, culture changes.
Yeah.
A huge,
well, it is, and so we have to take the long view on this.
Thank you for coming. I hope this won't be the last time.
Thank you. Grateful for the invitation.
Thank you.